we talked about rotating a spin, and we also talked about how to obtain the time evolution operator from the Hamiltonian in the case of uniform dynamics, and it was the same kind of answer for time evolution. We had that the operator for time evolution over a time interval of length t was just e to the minus I Hamiltonian times t over h bar, which was kind of cool and not too hard to understand. And then we also had for rotation about the z axis. We had that the rotation about the z-axis by an angle alpha for a spin 1/2 particle, we only talked about this for a spin 1/2 particle, that this rotation is e to the minus I, the z component of the spin, times alpha over h bar. And this was kind of neat. It's almost the same song in the second verse. Basically, we have our operators in the theory play two different roles. We have observables, which are Hermitian because they have real eigenvalues and so on. And and we also have state transformations. Which are typically described by unitary operators. Here, the observables here are the Hamiltonian, which is the energy observable, the z component of the angular momentum of the spin 1/2 particle. The state transformations are the time evolution transformation over a period of time t, the rotation about the axis, about the z axis. So state transformations, those are unitary operators. And the connection between them, sort of in rough terms, is that the unitary operators are e to the I Hermitian operator. That's actually true. If you take e to the I Hermitian operator, you get a unitary operator. And there seems to be some connection, interesting, significant connection, between the observables and the state transformations. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to take a few minutes at the beginning of class today to sort of generalize the moral and to connect it back to our main interest this week, which is time evolution. Because, of course, this rotation is not necessarily something to do with the evolution of the system over time. I'm not claiming, by defining this operator, I'm not claiming that the spin system actually is rotating somehow about the z-axis. I say, well, if you just rotated the state about the z-axis, what would the new state be? Okay, so the connection, of course, and before I go on, I should preface what I'm going to say by saying it's entirely possible. Every single word I say today will be familiar to you somehow. But let's just take that as a gift and go ahead and say it because I want to be able to draw on the language in a particular way later on. The connection between these, of course, is the idea of a symmetry. The idea of a symmetry. A symmetry, of course, is a state transformation that leaves something invariant. Symmetry is a transformation that leaves something invariant. And we're going to be particularly interested in dynamical symmetries. Okay. A dynamical symmetry will be a unitary operator V with the following property. If you start out with a state psi, and this state could be any state psi. One thing you can do, let's call it psi naught. one thing you can do is you can see how it evolves in time via time evolution operator U of t to some new state psi, which is u acting on psi naught. But I could also imagine the state that I get if I transform it according to the symmetry. Think of the symmetry as a mirror. If I look at this state in the mirror, I'll get the reflected state, if you will. And then I could imagine starting out in this transformed state and seeing how it evolves. And you wind up with, of course, uv psi naught. But what I want to say is that that v is a symmetry if the transformed version of psi naught has essentially the same dynamics as the original psi naught. That is to say, if I first do the time evolution and then reflect the result, I get exactly the same thing. I get exactly the same thing that I would get if I first looked at the reflected state and then evolved it. That these things would be exactly the same. The only significant statement here is that equals sign, or algebraically, the diagram commutes. And that means that my transformation V is a dynamical symmetry if the commutator between V and the evolution operator U of t is 0 for all t. And of course, my dynamics, I have uniform dynamics today. Okay, so that's pretty significant. That's a pretty significant statement. And in fact, there's another statement which is equally good, and that is since u of a small time delta is the identity minus I h delta over h bar plus higher order terms, then that means that if this commutator is 0, it must be that the commutator of V with H, with the Hamiltonian, is 0. Okay, now, and this means, for example, that we can find a basis of stationary states, energy eigenstates, which are also eigenstates of V. That is to say, states that only change by a phase if we act on them with the symmetry. States that observationally are symmetric under the transformation. We can find a common eigenbasis for the symmetry operation V and the Hamiltonian. Now, of course, we've seen an important fact about operators that commute with the Hamiltonian when they are observables. So let's think about an observable A, and let's suppose that AH is commutator is equal to 0. That means, of course, that A is conserved. You can either think of that as the expectation of A is constant for any initial state, or it's also the case that that if I transform this to the Heisenberg picture, then the Heisenberg version of A is the same as A. It's a constant time-independent operator. So that's one fact, but it's also the case that V... running into the seam here, so it's damaging my handwriting. V of s equal to e to the minus I s times a that this is a symmetry, is a dynamical symmetry for any S. You can see that because this exponential is just a power series, higher and higher powers of A, but A commutes with a Hamiltonian. Therefore, A commutes with H. Therefore, A commutes with the time evolution operator, which is a function of H. All the powers of A commute with all the powers of H. And so, this is a dynamical symmetry. For any S, that is, these V sub S's form a family, a one-parameter family of symmetry transformations. And you can see it's going to be one of those really nice one-parameter families where if I this additivity requirement holds. Just like in time evolution, just like in rotation. So now the connection between symmetries and conserved quantities and everything becomes clear. Every conserved quantity generates a family of symmetries, like so. And every smooth uniform family of symmetries, every family of dynamical symmetries like this, is actually generated by a conserved quantity. Okay? And finally, if this is true, it's the case that we can find a basis of stationary states, energy eigenstates, that are also eigenstates of A. But if you're an eigenstate of A, it also means that you're symmetric under the symmetry transformations for any S. So for example, suppose my rotation about the z-axis, Sz, commuted with my Hamiltonian. Then I would know that rotation about the z-axis by any angle would be a symmetry. That rotation, that family of rotations would be a nice, smooth, one-parameter family of dynamical symmetries for the system. I would know that I could find energy eigenstates that are also eigenstates of Sz. And I also know that eigenstates of Sz are symmetric. They don't change, except maybe in phase, if I rotate them about the z-axis. And that's a sort of a general kind of idea. And so what I want to do is I want to do an important example that you've all heard of, so I'll try to do it quickly. And that is, of course, the particle in one dimension. Okay? And there, our Hamiltonian is the momentum squared divided by twice the mass plus some potential function of x. Now, if v of x is a constant, then the momentum of the particle will commute with the Hamiltonian. If v of x is a constant, of course, I have a free particle. Then the momentum commutes with the Hamiltonian. And that means that there's a symmetry of the system, which is the symmetry generated by the momentum operator. Now, in order to do this, I need to worry. And let me point out here, I sort of elided over a little issue, and that is to say the argument the argument of an exponential has to be dimensionless. Because the exponential, of course, is the sum of successive powers of things, and I can't really add a length to a length squared to a length cubed and so on. It has to be dimensionless, and so this product had better to be dimensionless. The way I got away with it here is I employed h-bar to take care of the units. I had h has units of energy. T turns out to have units of time. Oh, yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I divide this by the units of action, h bar. And similarly here, the units of angular momentum are the same as the units of action. And alpha is just an angle, so it's radians. And that's the the unit that isn't the unit. It's meters per meter, dimensionless. So, okay, so so what have we got? Well, I'm gonna have to take care of some units, and of course the way to do that is to let my parameter S have units of length. Let the parameter S have units of length, and then consider the product P times S over H bar. And this P is an operator. S is just a parameter. H bar, of course, is our favorite constant, and that's going to be those units are going to be one. That'll be dimensionless, and so I'm going to consider my symmetry operation that I know is a symmetry on general grounds. Ts is going to be e to the minus I ps over h bar. Okay, so that's got to be a symmetry, a dynamical symmetry of the system. And we all know what that is, but I'm not going to say it yet. Okay, all right, I'm not going to say it yet. I'm going to find out what it is. How do I figure out what this is? Well, of course, this exponential is the identity minus I ps over h bar minus s squared over h bar squared p squared plus I s cubed. Oh, sorry, there's a 2 factorial here. Plus I over 3 factorial s cubed over h bar cubed p cubed, etc. I define it this way. And so the easiest way to see how this works, you'll see another way a little bit later. It's tomorrow afternoon. We have a problem where you look at it a different way. But it's to just think about this in the position representation. What does the momentum operator do in the position representation? Well, in the position representation, what I mean by that is simply write everything in terms of the position basis. I'm not thinking about this is a related but different use of the word than you might think of as a technical term in group theory. You have, of course, the wave function, which is the probability amplitude in the position basis, and of course the p operator takes the wave function to minus I h bar times the derivative of the wave function with respect to x, and p squared takes the wave function to the second derivative times minus h bar, and p cubed takes the wave function to I h bar cubed times the third derivative, and so on. And so that means I can tell what this transformation does to the wave function by simply telling how each of these terms applies to the wave function. So this says that the transformation, P of S, takes my wave function to, what is this? Well, let's see. The identity does nothing to the wave function, psi. The next term is I S over H bar times the momentum, but the momentum is minus I H bar times this. So I simply get plus S times the derivative of psi with respect to x. Sorry, minus S. Do it. Minus S? Let's see. Minus I here, and minus I. Yeah, minus sign. There's a minus sign. Good. And then this next one, I see my h bar squares are going to cancel. I've got a couple of minus signs, so I'm going to have plus S squared over 2 factorial second derivative of psi with respect to x, and so on. But of course, I recognize this as a Taylor series. This is a Taylor series. And in fact, what TS does is it takes psi to psi of x to psi of x minus s. The operator is actually a shift in the x direction. So if here's your wave function, then your wave function of x minus s is shifted to the right by s. That's not great, but it'll have to do. And that's the amount s. I've taken s to be positive. But of course, this works for any s. And that makes all kinds of sense because if the potential is a constant, then the Hamiltonian doesn't depend on where you are on the line. That's a symmetry of the system. You don't change the energy at all. And it also means that once again, we have the same story, third verse, where we get translation symmetry by an exponential of something of this form, where we have an observable, we have a translation operator, where we have an observable times a parameter divided by h bar. It all looks the same. It all looks the same. And that's good, because it's a lot easier to do the same problem five times than to do five different problems. Okay. All right. Any questions about this? Very familiar stuff, but I thought that it was worth making the general point. Okay, so I suppose we could add this to our list of these things. Translation T of S, which is unitary, is e to the minus I P S over h bar. Okay. Okay, so now I want to go back and talk about. Oh yeah, please.
So T is not observable, right?
What? No. T is a state transformation. It's a symmetry in this case, but in general, it's a unitary operator. Okay, it's a unitary operator, and what are its eigenstates? They're states that aren't changed, except by a phase, under translation, but those are the momentum eigenstates. So the momentum eigenstates are invariant except for a phase under translation in space. So, but it's intimately connected to the observable P, but it is actually a unitary transformation. Remember, our operators are playing two essential roles in the quantum theory. And then there's some auxiliary operators that are other kinds of things. But basically, we have observables, which are Hermitian, and state transformations, which are unitary. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Oh no! This is this. So each term of this comes from one of these operators, and the identity affects the wave function not at all. Okay, and then this operator, remember P is an operator, would affect psi this way. Now, notice how I've written this. I don't like to write operators acting on wave functions. It's perfectly okay to talk that way, but it is a little bit like confusing an operator with its matrix form. Okay, it's a specific representation of the operator. So I generally write, and I generally find it's sufficient to write things like this. Say, how does P change this? What that really would mean is something like this. If I were to really write this in honest operator language, what this really means is something like this, that x P psi is equal to minus I h bar derivative with respect to x of x psi.
That's really what this said. That's really what this is saying. The derivative with respect to x, of course, has to act on this the set of amplitudes, this wave function. But the operator doesn't act on this. The operator is inside the inner product. And I could write this, but I prefer just to write this as a more intuitive way of writing. Is this way of speaking clear? So anybody want to talk some more about it? Because I'll do this a lot. Okay, good. I'm glad this is not too confusing. Any other questions before I shift gears? Yeah.
It's a Taylor series.
Yeah. I don't
understand.
It's a Taylor series about x. Remember, this is psi of x, and these are all these derivatives evaluated at x, right? Evaluated at x. So if I let y, right. So if I imagine this to be y, so y is the new position, then what I would get is that for a Taylor series is that psi of y would equal to psi of x plus, I'll write it this way, psi prime of x times y minus x plus psi double prime of x over 2 factorial y minus x squared, and so on. Okay? Now, y minus x is nothing but minus s. Okay? Y minus x is nothing but minus s, and here I have successive powers of minus s, alternating signs, higher and higher powers of s. And so that's why it's a Taylor series. Does that help? Yeah. Yeah.
This relation between the Noether's theorem and this theorem,
right?
This is kind of a
quantum mechanical Noether's theorem. It's not quite so. Somewhere there's an action principle buried under our dynamics, which we'll see at the end of the week. It's a connection between conservation and continuous one parameter family of symmetries. Okay, the whenever I have one of these uniform families of symmetries, it's generated by an operator, which is a Hermitian operator that corresponds to a conserved observable. Right. But you can go the other way too. If you have a conserved quantity, you can from that build a continuous one parameter smooth family of symmetry operations. So it's the Noether's theorem connection, though it's not exactly Noether's theorem because we haven't mentioned an action. Yeah.
Logically, it seems possible to have an operator which is Hermitian and unitary.
Yeah, those are interesting operators. So suppose you had an operator that was both Hermitian and unitary. What could its eigenvalues be? Plus or minus one are the only possibilities. And therefore, it's an operator, for example, whose square is the identity. There are lots of interesting things. Like, for example, parity is a good example of that. Parity is a transformation. It's not a continuous transformation, but it's a transformation. But its square is the identity. It's its own dagger. It's Hermitian also. Its eigenvalues are plus or minus one. So parity is both the transformation and an observable that commutes with a Hamiltonian if parity is concerned. These two ideas are kind of degenerate in that case. Nice special cases. There are quite a few of them. Other questions?
Okay, let's proceed on. I want to go back to the idea of rotation and angular momentum. And what I want to talk about is the fact that this is a much more general relationship than just for spin one half. Once again, you've probably all seen it. In fact, I think it's guaranteed you've seen it. I think you've probably seen it recently. But I want to talk about it anyway because it's fun. So why can't I have something to do?
Whoa.
Okay. This seam I'm going to have to worry about. Okay. All right. So let's imagine a particle moving in three dimensions. And let's talk about the angular momentum for that particle. We have a particle in 3D, and we have, due to its motion in three dimensions, we have an angular momentum associated with that motion, which is orbital angular momentum. And orbital simply means associated with motion through space. And it has three component operators, z minus z to y, and cyclic. And LZ equals x to y minus y to x. Okay. And these are just components of a cross product. That sort of classically motivates us to consider these operators. But of course, it's a little, you don't really want to think of these things exactly as the components of a vector. You can do that formally, but of course, that vector's kind of tricky because, for example, you could not have a state, unless it's an angular momentum zero state, you can't have a state in which all three of the components of the vector are simultaneously well-defined. You know, something that's an eigenstate of all these things, because they don't commute with each other. So I prefer not to write the vector when I can help it, although that sometimes motivates some nice expressions. These guys satisfy commutation relations. You've probably worked out these commutation relations. You know, for example, if I take the commutation relation of Lx and Ly, when I look at Lx and Ly, everything in Lx commutes with everything in Ly except that that Pz in Lx won't commute with Z in Ly. Because, of course, X and Y and Px and Y and so on, things related to different Cartesian axes commute. The only things that don't commute are this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. And so when I take this commutator, there are only two terms. Those two terms are y commutator of pz with z px plus, two minus signs, of course, the commutator of these guys, which is x commutator of z and pz have py. These are the only two non-zero terms in the commutator. Of course, this is just IH bar times the identity. This is just the negative of that. And so I get IH bar times XPY minus YPX, which is IH bar LZ. and this means that of course, you can just cyclically permute X, Y, and Z. This means that we get exactly the same commutation relations that we previously got for the commutation, the commutators of the components of spin for a spin one-half particle. Sx, Sy commutator was I h bar Sz and cyclic. Okay, so that's kind of neat. It's very analogous to spin, what we saw before. And so if we have a particle in 3D, we're going to have a wave function, which is a function of position, which is just going to be position eigenstate inner product with the state. And this LZ operator will will take psi to Oh, of course, these momentum operators are just act on the wave function by the negative I h bar times the derivative. So I have minus I h bar times the x times the derivative of psi with respect to y minus y times the derivative of psi with respect to x. Okay, and as you've all seen before, it's really easiest if I write this in terms of spherical coordinates. Everybody knows about spherical coordinates. Okay, everybody here knows about spherical coordinates. I don't know if your Aunt Mary knows about them, but if she doesn't, go explain them to her because they're wonderful. Okay. Here are the Cartesian coordinates. The spherical coordinates are related to the Cartesian coordinates, of course. If you have a point out here somewhere, then the distance from the origin is the coordinate r. The angle from the z-axis is the polar angle phi. And if I project this down to the xy plane, that's a right angle seen in perspective, then the angle from the x-axis in the positive direction is the coordinate phi. So so it's easiest if we think of this, these labels, r, theta, phi, are just as good for labeling a position in space as x, y, and z. And so I can think of the wave function as a function of r, theta, and phi. And the reason that's good for this is that if I go ahead and work out the chain rule and I use the expressions for the various coordinates of one coordinate system in terms of the other, then it's not hard to work out that in fact LZ has a simple form or has a simple action in the spherical coordinates. It actually takes I to minus I h bar, the derivative of psi with respect to the azimuthal angle phi. Does anybody want me to go through that? Or have you seen that all in your lives too many times already? It's not hard. But it's, you need to know how to be able to do such calculations on your own, and of course you all do. So. Okay, so what's an LZ eigenstate? Well, an LZ eigenstate, LZ, has an eigenvalue which we'll write m h bar times the eigenvalue is m times h bar. That allows m to be dimensionless. And so, what kind of wave function would represent an eigenstate of z component of angular momentum? Well, of course, it's one that has to solve minus I h bar times the derivative of psi m with respect to phi equal to m h bar times the derivative of psi m with respect to phi. Of course, that's easy to solve. It's not the derivative. What am I saying? That's easy to solve because it's the derivative of something equal to a constant times something. So we know how to solve that. We know that the solutions to this are all of the form psi m of r, theta, and phi are equal to some function. I don't know what the function is of r and theta. Anyway, they something that acts like a constant with respect to phi, the independent variable for purposes of this, something that acts like a constant with that, times e to the I m phi. All of the eigenstates of LZ have to be of this form. And since this is a single-valued function of position, it must be the case that if I go around by 2 pi in phi, I'll have to come back to the I have to have this this exponential have the same value. So let's put it this way: e to the I m phi plus 2 pi had better be equal to e to the I m phi. And that means that m is an integer. It's 0, or it's plus or minus 1, or it's plus or minus 2, or something like that. It's an integer. Now, you probably remember wave functions like this, where you have some function of r and some spherical harmonics of theta and phi. And the spherical harmonics are some associated Legendre functions of theta times e to the I m phi. Probably remember something like this. And that's because these guys, you're trying not just to be an eigenstate of Lz, but something more specific, an eigenstate of L squared as well. And you can do that, but we don't need to do that. All we need is this for our discussion today. All we need is this fact, which is the easy fact. And we have that. Okay. Now, what happens if we rotate the state of our system about the z-axis by an angle alpha? What happens if we rotate the system by an angle alpha? So, rotate about the z-axis. What does rotation this do? Well, it takes the wave function for r, theta, and phi in general, and it maps it to a wave function. The wave function is exactly like this, except we've shifted the azimuthal angle, because the azimuthal angle tells you sort of how much you've rotated about the z-axis. So all it does is it makes it phi minus alpha. It's the same function, except playing the role of phi is now phi minus alpha, so that the whole thing has been shifted in the positive direction. The function has been shifted in the positive direction by alpha. Okay, so what does that mean about psi m? Well, psi m is f of r and theta e to the I m phi. So that gets transformed under a rotation to the same function e to the I m times phi minus alpha. But I'll write that as e to the I phi times e to the I m phi times e to the minus I m alpha. That is to say, it's e to the minus I m alpha times the original wave function, which is good. It tells us that that this is great. It says that the z eigenstate of the eigenstate of z component of angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, is symmetric under rotations about the z-axis. In fact, it tells me more. It tells me more. Look at this. This m is related to the eigenvalue of Lz. So that tells me, since this is true for any eigenstate, and since I can write anything as a superposition of eigenstates, it does tell me that for orbital angular momentum, the same kind of relation between the angular momentum variable and the rotation operator obtains. It tells me that a rotation by alpha about the z-axis is in fact e to the minus I LZ alpha over H bar. Which is pretty cool. The same connection between angular momentum and rotation holds for orbital angular momentum, as we can see by just looking at how the wave function transforms. All right, well, that's neat. But in fact, it's a clue. Yeah?
I was just going to point out that for the spin half particle rotation, we didn't have to impose the single valueness.
Oh, well, of course, we weren't writing that in terms of a wave function. Here we're assuming that the particle is completely described by a single valued spatial wave function. Single value because this inner product has some particular value at every point in space. But I'll get to that what this all means in connection with spin soon. Okay, right. So this is the preview. Okay, what I'm going to talk about next, though, is that this is not just something really convenient. It actually tells us what angular momentum means. I mean, think about it. Orbital angular momentum is kind of easy to understand because it's angular momentum that is built out of the position and momentum of the particle. But spin angular momentum is a little funny because it has something to do with the internal state of the particle. And actually really doesn't have anything to do, really, with masses moving through space. Okay? The picture we have in our heads is the solar system model, where the planet has our angular momentum due to its motion about the sun and angular momentum due to its rotation about its axis. But really, both of those kinds of angular momentum have to do with particles moving through space, masses moving through space. Both of those are really orbital angular momentum from the quantum mechanical point of view. Spin is something else. So what's going on? Well, let's see if we can understand this by thinking a little bit about the geometry of rotation, which you have done before. I know this is all review, but that will just make it more likely that you'll catch my mistakes. Okay, so let's just consider rotations in three dimensions. So we have x, y, and z axes, and we imagine we have some point out here, and we suppose this point is rotated. That we rotate the whole system about the z-axis. So what I'm really thinking about is that there's a circle that this lies on, and as I rotate about the z-axis, this point in space, this x, y, z point, goes to other points like this guy. So this is the z coordinate is unchanged. Here's an angle alpha, and here's x prime, y prime, z prime right here. And I've rotated by alpha to go from one to the other. And as I rotate, this thing will trace out a circle. And so I want to just remind you of the of how that works. Of course, how it works is that x, y, z goes to x prime, y prime, z prime, which is equal to some rotation matrix acting on x, y, and z. And there'll be a matrix that represents rotation about the z-axis by a certain angle. There'll be a matrix representing rotation about the x-axis, and so on. And it doesn't take much to work out what those matrices are. Let me just write the z one, rz. I'll indicate that it's a matrix by putting a little twiddle over the top of it. And what is that? Well, it's pretty easy to work out. The cosines are on the diagonal. There's one in the z position. Z the z component doesn't change. And all I have to do is think about which one of these is sine and which one's minus sine. And this one's the minus. Okay, all right. So that's this. There are also rotations about the x and the y axes. Now, what I want to do is I want to look at these rotation matrices for small angles. I'm going to imagine that that I rotate by the angle epsilon. And I'm going to keep terms including the order epsilon squared term, but not higher. I'm going to keep the constant terms. I'm going to keep the order epsilon terms. I'm going to keep the order epsilon squared terms, but I'm not going to keep any higher order terms. I'm going to work to order epsilon squared. And then I can just write down what these matrices are. What's this one, for example? What's RZ acting on RZ by epsilon? Well, that's easy because I can just expand the cosine and sine in power series in the argument, and I have to keep two terms for the cosine. I get 1 minus epsilon squared over 2. For the sine, it's just epsilon. And I've got 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. Okay, so this is the rotation matrix up to order epsilon squared. And let me go ahead and write down what this is for rotations about the y and z axes too. It's just the same, except the terms are scrambled around a little bit. You can get any of them by the others by thinking about cyclic permutations of the rows and columns. And so let me just write that down. Rx epsilon is equal to, and this is of course plus order epsilon cubed, I guess I should say. Right. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1 minus epsilon squared over 2, minus epsilon, 1 minus epsilon squared over 2, and then Ry epsilon is equal to 1 minus epsilon squared over 2. There's a sort of a 0, 1, 0, 0. I have the minus epsilons down here. 1 minus epsilon squared over 2. There you go. So these are the rotation matrices for small rotations about the x, y, and z axes. Now, of course, these rotations do not commute with each other. These rotations do not commute with each other. If you rotate about the x-axis and then rotate about the y-axis, it's not the same thing as rotating about the y-axis and then rotating about the x-axis. The rotations don't commute as a geometrical fact. And you know, everyone has seen where you grab a book and you do a rotation this way and then a rotation that way, and you get one orientation of the book, or then you first do the rotation this way and then you do the rotation that way, and you get a completely different orientation of the book. So it doesn't commute. So that means that let's imagine that I do a rotation. I do four rotations. The first one that I want to do is a rotation about the y-axis by epsilon. And then I'm going to do a rotation about the x-axis by epsilon. So in the, I'm going to write this as a single matrix. And of course, I have to read the order at, on which I apply the rotations from left to right, because this is the one that applies first to the vector, then this one, and so on. OK, so this is not the same. This is not the same as the rotations in the other direction. And the way I'm going to get at that is by considering I do this rotation, then I do that rotation, then I undo the first rotation, then I undo the second rotation. So I go ry minus epsilon and rx minus epsilon. And that's not quite the unit matrix. That's not quite the unit matrix. So what is it really? Well, I can just write out these matrices based on these expressions, and then multiply them. And I do a bunch of stuff that's dull but easy. Okay. And what do I get? Well, I get the following kind of cool looking matrix. I get a 1 here, and a minus epsilon squared here, and an epsilon squared here, and a 1 here, and a 1 here, like this. I've thrown away, of course, all the order epsilon cubed terms. And there are going to be some, given by products of these terms. But I throw those away because I've resolved to not to keep those. These are the only ones up through order epsilon squared. When I look at that, I say, that looks awfully familiar. In fact, it looks just like a rotation about the z-axis by the angle epsilon squared. That's a rotation about the z-axis by epsilon squared. That's why I kept terms up to order epsilon squared, so I would see the difference between this product and the identity. Okay, well, that's a fact of three-dimensional geometry, that if I do rotations about the axes by these angles in this order, it's equivalent to doing this rotation. That's a geometrical fact. Well, what does this mean for a quantum system? What does this mean for a quantum system? Well, these rotations aren't matrices acting on coordinates. They're some operators acting on the state space of the system. And so I'm going to have rotation operators like we've been talking about before, operators that are unitary operators, that are state transformations, transformations of the state, that are the changes that the particle state would get if you rotated the particle about the various axes by various angles. And for each axis, these guys form a nice, smooth, continuous one-parameter family. And so those operators are going to be generated by something. They're going to be generated by something, because the angles compose in that nice linear way. So let me just write that down. Let's write this down. Rx by alpha is going to be equal to e to the minus I gx alpha, and I don't know what gx is. It's some operator. It's Hermitian, but I don't know what it is yet. There is going to be such an operator. And if you want to find out what it is, gx is equal to, I can get gx by taking the appropriate derivative of r with respect to alpha. I'll leave that to you. And similarly, there are other operators that are the generators for the for these families of rotations about the other axes. I don't know anything about how the rotation affects the quantum state of my system. But I do know that however that those rotations affect the quantum state of the system, that it's describable in this way, where these gx, gy, and gz operators, these are generators. They generate the rotations about x, y, and z. And they're dimensionless operators. They're dimensionless operators because alpha is an angle, it's dimensionless, and the product has to be dimensionless because it's the argument of an exponential. Okay, if this is true, then I can do the same kind of calculation that I did here with the rotation operators. I can consider r x by minus epsilon times r y minus epsilon times r x epsilon times r y epsilon. And I can work it out to order epsilon squared. And so what do I get? Well, I have to write everything down to order epsilon squared. I'm going to get 1 plus igx epsilon squared minus, epsilon minus epsilon squared over 2 gx squared times. That's what I get from this one. This plus sign comes from the fact that I'm rotating by minus. By minus epsilon, and all the way up to the last one, which is 1 minus I g y epsilon minus epsilon squared over 2 g y. I'm working everything out to order epsilon squared through. Yes, it should be squared. Thank you. Now. There are going to be four terms like this, right? Four factors like this. And when I multiply them all together, that's a lot of terms. That's 81 terms. But luckily, I don't have to consider most of them. There's, of course, going to be one term that's the identity, where the four identities are multiplied together. And then there's going to be a term. Then there's going to be a term where it's the first order terms, the epsilon terms. And there are going to be four of those, one from each one of these guys multiplied by the identities, right? But those are going to cancel because there's going to be an igx epsilon and there's going to be a minus igx epsilon. There's going to be an igy epsilon and a minus igy epsilon. So there's not going to be any first order terms left. So all I have to worry about are the second order terms. There are going to be quite a few of those. Okay, I'm going to get the four terms, which are these terms times the identities and the other three factors. And I'm going to get six terms, which are products of these guys. And once more, we have a bunch of dull but easy calculation. I invite you to do it on your own. Dull but easy calculation. It turns out that this is 1 minus I epsilon squared times, no, it's not I epsilon squared. Sorry. Yep, there's no I's, of course. There are no I's. I get gx, gy, minus gy, gx. These are the only terms that survive. When I multiply all these things out together. Okay. It's dull but easy. That much stuff right there. Okay. And not yet. Yes. Now. That's what this is, but what would a rotation about the z-axis by epsilon squared be? Well, that would be 1 minus I epsilon squared gz. Now, I said before as a fact of geometry that a rotation, a rotation about the x and y, where you first go by epsilon about y, and then by epsilon about x, and then by minus epsilon about y, and minus epsilon about z, that is as a fact of geometry to order through order epsilon squared. That's a rotation about the z-axis by epsilon squared. That's what it is. You can make a rotation about the z-axis in that way if you can rotate about the x and y-axes. Similarly, I'm going to insist that that same geometrical relation between the rotations has to obtain for the effects of the rotation on the quantum state. I don't know what that quantum state is. I don't know how it's affected. But I know that if I do this to it, it's got to be the same thing as doing this to it. And that means that, well, you can see. Therefore, we conclude that this thing in parentheses, that the commutator of gx and gy must be equal to I times gz. That must be true for the geometry of rotations to be properly reflected in the effect of the rotations on the quantum state of the system. Got to be true. And you get the same thing if you cyclically permute x, y, and z. So I'll just say, and cyclic. Okay. So in fact, what we're going to do is we're going to define the angular momentum operators for a system. Define the angular momentum operators to be SX is just H bar times GX and so on. The operators are defined to be up to a factor of H bar, which we put in for traditional reasons of units. They're defined to be the generators of rotation. So rotation about the x-axis by alpha is equal to e to the minus I sx alpha over h bar, ry alpha is equal to e to the minus I sy alpha over h bar, and rz by alpha is equal to e to the minus I sz alpha over h bar. And these things hold not because of some really cool coincidence, these hold by definition of sx, sy, and sz. These are by definition of sx, sy, and sz. And the operators so defined will have the right commutation relations. That just reflects the geometry of rotation. So let's imagine you take a system maybe consisting of an electron in an atom, and you rotate the system. What's going to happen? Well, two things are going to be affected by that rotation. The wave function of the electron's position will be affected. The wave function of the electron's position will be affected. And the internal state of the electron will be affected somehow. Okay? Because the electron also has internal properties. So there are going to be two kinds of operators. There's going to be operators which generate the effect on the spatial wave function. Those guys are going to be the orbital angular momentum. And they're going to be operators which affect the which govern the effect of the rotation on the internal state of the electron, those are going to be the spin operators. This view of angular momentum doesn't necessarily have anything to do with masses moving through space. If your internal state, if your state is would be affected by a rotation in space, then you have angular momentum. That's what angular momentum is. This tells me, for example, that if a system is really symmetric under rotations, if the state of a system is unchanged by rotations, then without any further calculation, I can tell you, ah, yes, that's a zero angular momentum state. And so that's what this is, if you will, it's more of a transformational view of what angular momentum is. Angular momentum is the Hermitian operator that generates rotations in space. Okay, so this all looks familiar, right? Utterly familiar. Old hat. So is the next thing, I'm afraid. I'll save the gory details for next time, but I hope to do it in about 10 minutes. Okay, 15 minutes at the beginning of next time. And that is to derive, which you've already seen, I know, but I want to do it anyway because I want to be able to pull pieces out of it later on. To start with nothing but the angular momentum commutation relations. Because these are the guys that sort of contain the geometry of rotation. Okay, these are the things sort of have to be true if these angular momentum operators are going to be associated with rotations in space. To start with the angular momentum commutators and get everything from that, all about angular momentum, and you know how this goes. But I do want to review it because I'll want to have particular expressions in particular notation for next week in particular. So I want to do that. So the new project is to start with only the angular momentum commutation relations and derive everything about angular momentum from that. And I'll do that at the beginning of class next time, because I don't want to start it and then have to end. So I'll just to even save more time at the beginning of class, for the first 15 minutes of class tomorrow, h bar will be equal to 1. And so g and s are the same thing. Okay, so we'll throw out all the h bars. We'll just have an h bar holiday Thursday morning for 10 minutes. And that's all. Any questions? Want to talk about some more? Anything more? Yeah.
Can we assume that doing the rotations in space affect that product that gave the rotation around z with an angle squared? We based the, like, to get the relations commutator between generations, we use that effect. Like,
yes.
If you use the rotation like of 2 pi in real space to give the identity.
Yeah, but
and it would be wrong. So why?
Correct. And that's because imagine a rotation occurring this is an interesting point. We got a couple of minutes. Let me just explain this to you. Let's just imagine the geometry of rotations in space. Okay, and you may have heard that any orientation of an object can be gotten from you can get to it from this orientation of the object by finding some axis and rotating up to pi about that axis. So any orientation in space, have you guys ever heard this fact? You can get to any orientation by finding an appropriate axis and rotating by an angle between minus pi and pi about that axis. So if you will, I could represent the space of orientations of a three-dimensional object. I could represent that space by a kind of a sphere. Okay, and this is orientations of a 3D object. And this is some reference orientation in the middle, and a point, the sphere has radius pi, okay? The sphere has radius pi, and if I'm here, that says take this direction in space and rotate by that angle, okay? And that would give me some new orientation from my original orientation. So now let's suppose that I actually rotate an object by a little bit about the z-axis, a little bit by the y-axis, a little bit about x-axis, and so on. Small rotations. That will correspond to some not necessarily closed path. In fact, I argued that to order epsilon squared it wasn't closed, but that'll represent some small path that stays close to the origin. The orientation of the object doesn't change much in the course of that. Okay? But now let's suppose I take an object and I rotate it about some axis by 2 pi. Okay? Well, the history of that object's orientation in space is going to be a path. Oh, and opposite points here are the same. Because if I rotate about this axis by pi, it's the same as rotating about that axis by pi. Okay? So these are the same point. So the trajectory and orientation space will go through here, from here, back to here. Okay, it's a closed path. It's a closed path, but it's not a path that is homotopic to zero. It's not a path. However you modify this path, if you make small modifications on it, so you go like this, then it still makes a complete loop around. No matter what you do, you can't get rid of that loop. Whereas, if you have some wobble of it that changes the orientation like this, I could make a small change in that orientation. Make a small change in that orientation and contract that loop to the identity. So the point is that there's a topological difference between a history of the object that where the object stays close to its original orientation and the history of an object where that object actually rotates all the way around the axis, an axis once. They're topologically different histories for the object. Now, let's suppose you rotate twice. I like this part. Let's suppose that you go around twice around the axis. You rotate by 4 pi. So you start out at this orientation, and you go out to here, and you come in here, and I'll add a little wobble so I don't go over the same line twice, so you can really see what's going on. Then I go to here. This is, of course, the zero rotation. I go to here, so this is 1 connects to 1, then I go to 2, and 2 is connected to here, and I come back to here. Okay? Now, I can slowly change that path. I can gradually change that double rotation to a more complicated wobble. Each time I do this more complicated 4 pi wobble, it changes a little bit, and I can make it go to here, for example. Now here's the new one that comes in over here, and then I make it go over to here. Boy, I really am pushing this too hard. Just too enthusiastic about things. Here's the new 2. That comes over to here and goes back to there. Okay? That's a slight perturbation of the original path. But notice that I can continue to do this. I can get another a permutation of that guy where I go to here. I go to here. There's point 1. Therefore, point 1 shows up here, bloops over to point 2, and back to here, and so on. If you keep doing this, the next time, it'll look like this. And you can, in fact, continuously deform a rotation of about an axis by 4 pi, you can continuously deform that to an orientation history That is the identity all the time. You can continuously deform that history back to here. So a rotation by 4 pi is topologically equivalent to no rotation at all. Okay? Which means that it might make sense for a 3-dimensional rotation by 2 pi to be have a distinct action on a system. Because remember, these operators are assumed to be part of not just a magic 2 pi rotation. It's a 2 pi rotation that's part of a whole continuous family of rotations. So you can imagine building up that rotation by small steps, following a trajectory in orientation space. It makes sense that it would be possible for the 2 pi rotations to be different from the identity, but the 4 pi rotations would have to be the identity because they are topologically equivalent to no rotation at all. It's a sort of a way of looking at what's going on in space. If this doesn't make sense to you, it's quite off the main track of the course. So, just any questions about this or anything else? Yeah.
Show me exactly the path you're going on.
Okay. So I've actually been fiddling with some ray tracing programs trying to get a movie of an object going through this path and then going through this path, and so you see it. Basically, what happens? Each point on this is an orientation that I would obtain by rotating by this angle about that direction. So each point on here is this. So this guy, you have to imagine that about this axis, I rotate once and then again about that same axis. And rotating by pi this direction is the same as rotating by minus pi. So these two points are identified. So the white diagram is pretty much a simple rotation, except I've displaced them a little bit so you can see that it's really two paths.
So those are rotation axes?
Each point on this specifies a rotation axis. Okay. So each point on this trajectory, I look at this vector, and this vector tells me a direction in space, and the length of the vector tells me an angle between 0 and pi. The circle has radius pi. And so this point says that at this point in the history, the object is in an orientation that you could obtain by rotating about this direction by this angle, the angle represented by that radius of that little arrow, okay, and so every one of these points is a different orientation in space, and so if I wanted to look at this white curve, it would be a rotation by 2 pi, except the second time around, maybe it's shifted a little bit, it's nodded forward a little bit, so it rotates and then it rotates around, so it doesn't quite go over the same path. And then it sort of exaggerates that so that the second time through is more and more, the second time around is more and more different from the first time around, and eventually you're seeing that it's just making a little wobble, and the wobble as you go from the white to the orange to the green to the purple, the wobble contracts towards zero. It's a way of thinking about this 2 pi business. Yeah. It's a sphere, except the opposite points are identified. Okay? So it's not really a sphere. It's topologically something else.
It's a ball, right?
It's a ball. Well, it's got all the interior points, of course. It's a ball, but the opposite points are identified. So what is that? That's kind of some kind of projective space or something. It's really the manifold for O3+. The connected component of the orthogonal 3x3 real matrices. That's really a picture of that manifold. But I like thinking about it this way. Yeah?
I don't really understand why the 2 pi rotation can't be different.
Ah, well, it turns out that no matter any small, let's look at that 2 pi rotation, okay? The question is, so here's the center. The question is the object ever, in its history, ever at a point where exactly opposite from where it's exactly a pi rotation about some axis from where it is now. And this path, no matter how I alter this path in a small way, these two points have to be antipodal. So no matter how this point gets modified, it can't get any closer to this one. So the path can't contract to zero because it's always stuck at the edge. But here, there are 4 points. So although one can't get any closer to one, one and two can get close together and annihilate each other and get rid of the loop, get rid of the the passage around. So that's why. That's why. Okay. So I think that's all today, because we need to clear out so that